Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Secretary General Antonio Guterres visited the National University of Lviv in Ukraine on Thursday. There, he reflected on the importance of civil society and academia in the development of modern democracies. Mr. Guterres said that the school had made very important contributions to the organization, specifically to the UN Charter, as Luis Sun, a co-author, had graduated from there. The university has also contributed extensively to Holocaust research and to the analysis of human rights violations and genocide. The Secretary General arrived at Lviv on Wednesday and will go on to Odessa and Istanbul, Turkey, over the following days. While in the country, he will stop by one of the three Ukrainian ports, participating in the framework of the Black Sea Initiative to export wheat grain. Moving to Afghanistan, the UN mission in the country, UNAMA, deplored Wednesday's attack on a mosque in Kabul. An explosion ripped through a crowded mosque in the Afghan capital, claiming over 20 lives and injuring 40 others, according to media reports. This is the latest in the disturbing series of bombings that have killed and injured more than 250 people in recent weeks. According to UNAMA, it marks the highest monthly number of civilian casualties over the last year. Amidst deteriorating security throughout the country, the UN called on the de facto Taliban authorities to take concrete steps to prevent all forms of terrorism in Afghanistan. On Twitter, the UN mission expressed its sympathies to the families of those killed and called for more support for vulnerable communities. Thursday marks 4 years since the passing of former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, regarded by many as a guiding force for good. Across the UN system, messages paid tribute to Mr. Annan, remembering him as an advocate for a better, fairer world. Serving as UN Secretary General from 1997 to 2005, Mr. Annan championed many significant initiatives. From stronger human rights to global peacekeeping operations and revitalizing the UN itself by creating the new role of Deputy Chief, an effective ethics office, and zero tolerance for sexual exploitation, his legacy lives on. Anna Carmo, UN News.
For radio as godless as our constitution, tune into Free Thought Radio. We talk with FFRF attorney Sam Grover on his blog about why constitutional absolutes are killing us. And then we interview Professor Michael Graziano about his new book, Errant into the Wilderness of Mirrors, Religion and the History of the CIA.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's rejected a call by the United Nations to create a demilitarized zone around the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station as fighting threatens Europe's largest nuclear plant. Russia's foreign ministry Thursday called the Russian army's occupation of the site in southeastern Ukraine a guarantee against a Chernobyl scenario, a reference to the 1986 nuclear catastrophe in northern Ukraine. Russia's rejection of the deal follows Thursday's visit by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to Lviv in western Ukraine, where he met with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Guterres said fighting by Russia in Ukraine near the plant risks a worldwide nuclear disaster.
Military equipment and personnel should be withdrawn from the plant. Further deployment of forces or equipment to the site must be avoided. The area needs to be demilitarized. And we must tell it as it is. Any potential damage to Zaporizhzhia is suicide.
Today, the UN Secretary General is visiting the coastal city of Odessa to inspect grain shipments after a UN Turkey broker deal guaranteed safe passage to Ukrainian ships in the Black Sea. Here in the United States, a federal judge has given the Justice Department 1 week to make public parts of an affidavit used by federal agents to search Donald Trump's Florida home earlier this month. U.S. Judge Bruce Reinhart ruled Thursday portions of the affidavit should be redacted, but that it was in the interest of the public and the media to unseal the document. The affidavit will provide clues to how the FBI established probable cause in its search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, where agents recovered 11 sets of classified documents, many of them marked top secret. Federal prosecutors probing Donald Trump's role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol have sent a grand jury subpoena to the National Archives asking for all the documents that provided to the House January 6th committee. This comes amidst reports the U.S. Secret Service failed to inform Capitol Police about a threat made against Speaker Nancy Pelosi until after the January 6th attack was underway. That's according to a new report by the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which cited email communications between law enforcement officials around the time of the insurrection. In Texas, the elections administrator of Gillespie County and her entire staff have quit over death threats, harassment, and incidents of stalking after Joe Biden's victory in 2020. Anissa Herrera told the local newspaper, quote, after the 2020 election, I was threatened. I've been stalked. I've been called out on social media, and it's just dangerous misinformation, she said. Donald Trump won the county by a 59-point margin. Here in New York, the Trump Organization's chief financial officer has pleaded guilty to 15 felony charges of tax evasion and other illicit business practices. Alan Weisselberg admitted to a judge in Lower Manhattan Thursday he unlawfully took home nearly $1.8 million in off-the-books compensation from the Trump family business over a number of years. Those rent-free perks included lease payments for a luxury car, private school tuition for his grandchildren, free use of a luxury apartment overlooking Central Park. Under terms of a plea deal, Weisselberg has agreed to testify as a prosecution witness against the Trump Organization when it goes on trial in October. However, he did not agree to directly implicate Donald Trump or members of the Trump family. Weisselberg was sentenced to 5 months at New York's notorious Rikers Island Jail, where he's expected to spend as little as 100 days behind bars. To date, more than two dozen people from Trump's inner circle have been imprisoned or face criminal indictment. In climate news, China's deployed cloud-seeding airplanes over drought-stricken parts of the country as hundreds of millions of people endure China's longest heat wave on record. This week, China's Ministry of Water Resources ordered planes to drop silver iodide into the clouds over Hubei province, where prolonged heat has damaged crops and led parts of the Yangtze River to run dry. Similar scenes are playing out along rivers in Europe, including the Rhine, the Danube and the Loire in western France, where this week residents visited dry riverbeds that are normally covered with meters of water.
It makes me sad. It makes me sad because I grew up in the village and I've never seen the Loire like that. Before, we could go to the water holes over there with the children and fish because the water was not too hot yet. Now when we go, it's just algae and frogs. All the fish died of the heat or were eaten by the herons.
The low river levels have impacted France's 56 nuclear plants, many of which rely on river water to keep their reactors cool. This week, French officials granted an exemption to environmental laws to allow nuclear plants to discharge hot water into already warming local rivers. This comes as Europe's glaciers are experiencing their worst summer melt season on record. Scientists with the European Commission say this summer's extreme drought could be the continent's worst in 500 years. Here in New York, police arrested 10 climate campaigners Thursday as they held a peaceful sit-in protest inside the Manhattan offices of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. The activists are demanding Schumer and other Democratic leaders reverse fossil fuel-friendly concessions in the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act. One provision added to win the support of West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin fast-tracks approval of the Mountain Valley Fracked Gas Pipeline. Another side deal limits public input on major new infrastructure projects while weakening environmental review procedures. This is activist Gigi Neeson of the group No North Brooklyn Pipeline.
Making side deals to advance your political agenda with Joe Manchin, who takes more fossil fuel money than any member of Congress. It's undemocratic, unjust, and racist because it'll take public voices out of the decision-making process, especially those from Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities.
The Biden administration says it allowed 1.8 million doses of monkeypox vaccine to the U.S. supply as it struggles to contain the largest ever outbreak of the viral disease outside Africa. Last week, the Food and Drug Administration approved a plan to stretch the vaccine supply by administering one-fifth of a normal dose per patient. Critics say there's limited data showing whether the strategy will be effective. The U.S. leads the world in confirmed monkeypox cases with over 14,000, more than a third of the worldwide total, though disease experts say the true number of infections is likely far higher. Public health data show black men have been disproportionately affected by monkeypox, but are receiving the vaccine at much lower rates than other groups. This comes after the head of the Centers for Disease Control is announcing a sweeping reorganization of the CDC. Dr. Rochelle Walensky acknowledged failures in the CDC's response to COVID-19 and promised better communication with researchers and the public. This week, the Biden administration signaled it will stop buying COVID-19 vaccines, treatments, and tests as early as this fall. White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha spoke at an event sponsored by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation.
Getting us out of that acute emergency phase where the U.S. government is buying the vaccines, buying the treatments, buying the diagnostic tests. We need to get out of that business over the long run. And so my hope is that in 2023, you're going to see the commercialization of almost all of these products. Some of it is actually going to begin this fall.
In Colorado, a grand jury is investigating a Denver police shooting that left at least seven people injured in July. Recently released body cam footage revealed new details of the chaos that unfolded. Denver police had reportedly previously omitted to report key facts from earlier descriptions of the shooting, including that the man they were pursuing, 21-year-old Jordan Waddy, was throwing away his handgun when police shot him anyway, and that Waddy had raised his hands when police first approached him. Six bystanders who were standing nearby were also wounded. In Tennessee, a federal judge has ordered the coffee giant Starbucks to offer to rehire seven workers who were fired after they led a campaign to unionize a store in Memphis. Since Starbucks workers in Buffalo organized the chain's first U.S. union last year, Starbucks has faced dozens of unfair labor practice charges, including over 200 violations of federal workers' protection stemming from retaliation claims. To see our interview with union organizer Beto Sanchez, one of the Memphis Seven, go to democracynow.org. In Argentina, massive anti-government protests continue denouncing worsening unemployment, poverty, and skyrocketing inflation and living costs. On Wednesday, thousands of workers, union members, and social justice advocates took to the streets of Buenos Aires demanding the government of President Alberto Fernández increase living wages and do more to address the crisis.
Today in Argentina, it is a privilege to eat. In other words, such a fundamental right for families, especially for many women who are heads of household. Today, they cannot even guarantee daily milk for their children. In Argentina, there are many problems. We from the popular movement are proposing that we have to move forward with a universal basic wage, an income that would at least put an end to indigence in Argentina.
And in Mexico, a truth commission formed by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has confirmed the involvement of federal and state authorities in the 2014 disappearance of 43 students in Ayotzinapa, calling it a high-level cover-up state crime. The commission also said there's no indication any of the students are alive. Their disappearance sparked international condemnation and mounting accusations of human rights abuses against former President Enrique Peña Nieto. The students' families for years have expressed hope. Some of them had survived, often leading protests where they chanted, "You took them alive, we want them back alive." Next month will mark Ayotzinapa's eighth anniversary. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. We'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
I'm Amit Pal, and this is the August 18th, 2022 episode of Free Thought Radio, coincidentally my wife's birthday. I'm guest hosting the show today since Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor are in Germany this week for the International Celebrating Dissent Conference, an event that the Freedom From Religion Foundation is co-sponsoring that deals with the difficulties of dissenting from religion, especially in Muslim-dominated countries. When they return, they will surely tell us all about it. Grant Blaschke, with Audio for the Arts, is engineering today's show in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall, the national offices of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in good old Madison, Wisconsin. The Freedom From Religion Foundation works to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about the views of non-theists, that's atheists, agnostics, secular humanists, and other non-religious individuals. We have about a dozen full-time attorneys, legal fellows, and interns filing lawsuits and amicus briefs, writing letters of complaint to government officials on behalf of our members who want to keep religion out of government. To become a member of FFRF, visit ffrf.org and click on the Join button. Or you can simply ask for information by selecting the Request Info link, and we will send you a sample copy of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. Or you can call us at 1-800-335-4021. As John Lennon famously said, you hope today you'll join us. This week is the anniversary of the birthday of the French composer Claude Debussy. He was born August 22, 1862. Debussy rejected all creeds. "I do not practice religion in accordance with the sacred rites," he said. "I've made mysterious nature my religion." Listen for some of Debussy's music today, including Rhapsody for Saxophone and Gardens in the Rain, played by Jared Dunn right here in the office on the FFRF Steinway Piano in Free Thought Hall. You can learn more about the lives and views of contemporary and historical free thinkers like Debussy at our Free Thought of the Day website at ffrf.org/day. There's a bunch going on that we've been involved with over the past couple of weeks, and we'd like to fill you in on all of our activities. We had a series of very fascinating and incisive blogs on our website. One of them we'll be discussing at length, and that's FFRF attorney Sam Grover's blog on how constitutional absolutes are killing us. And we'll have him interviewed in the second segment. But apart from that, we had a series of other really insightful and amazing blogs on our website, and I'd like to talk with you about those. FFRF contributing writer Barbara Alvarez urges secularists and freethinkers to stand up for critical thinking. She writes, as a public librarian for nearly 10 years in 5 different libraries, I can personally attest to the positive impact of being surrounded by a variety of information and patrons asking for a range of resources. Yet, public libraries are facing attacks at heightened levels. She provides concrete examples from the very recent past. For example, the residents of a township in Western Michigan have recently voted to defund a library there because it was carrying LGBTQ materials. And as she points out, PEN America has said that there's an alarming spike in book bans. Over 1,500 individual books were banned in a 9-month period in 2021. It's quite incredible. And Barbara, that's why, urges us all to stand up on behalf of critical thinking and intellectual freedom, inquiry and dialogue in places such as, but not limited to, public libraries. Another person here in the office, an intern of ours, Jeff Mollett, has written another fascinating blog tying in all the problematic ways in which Christian nationalism and the Christian flag is interlinked. Many members of Congress recently, such as Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, have called for a dissolution of the wall of separation between state and church, and the flag has been used in this respect. The flag was on display during the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, and again was on display when the U.S. Supreme Court allowed it to be flown at the Boston City Hall recently. Jeff writes about all this and the ways in which right-wing Christian nationalist groups try to use the occasion to propound a religious state and a theocracy in spite of the fact that Thomas Jefferson and the founders, John Adams, for example, were of a completely different mind. And this, as he says, Christian nationalism is a real danger to our democracy and undercuts the values on which our country was founded. In yet another very well-written blog, Jim Haught, veteran freethinker and writer whose blogs we use on a weekly basis, has written about an amazing Nobel-winning skeptic, a physicist by the name of Subramanian Chandrasekhar, a piece that's very close to my heart because, like me, Chandrasekhar had his roots in India. He was much more brilliant than I am. And at the age of 19, as Haught points out, on a boat trip to England, he first proposed the notion of the Chandrasekhar limit, which is the limit of mass that dwarf stars reach before they collapse. He was scoffed at and ridiculed. A half a century later, in 1983, he finally got the Nobel Prize in Physics for the Chandrasekhar limit. Interestingly enough, and this is an amazing anecdote, when reporters came to tell him the news about him receiving the Nobel, he said that he must hurry to class, but he wasn't teaching this class, although he was a professor at the University of Chicago. He was a student in his 70s. Chandrasekhar also said that, I am not religious in any sense. In fact, I can characterize myself definitely as an atheist. Speaking of people with Indian roots, there's somebody whose roots are in India, just like me, who's been, unfortunately, very much in the news in the past week. And that I'm talking about none other than writer Salman Rushdie, who was attacked grievously recently. And of course, we have been following that closely. We've decried the vicious attack on him. We were privileged to spend time with him when he graced our 2018 annual convention in San Francisco. As we point out in our piece, in our statement, the attack on him stems from the completely absurd notion of blasphemy. Blasphemy is such a bizarre concept. It's a victimless crime, but it ironically creates innocent victims, either through blasphemy laws, in place in 80 countries or through vigilante ventures, such as the guy who sort of undertook to kill Rushdie, this Shiite extremist, was engaged in. Rushdie is a brilliant writer. This cannot be said enough. His Midnight Children is a landmark in English, in Indian writing in English. He's also been outspoken about a range of issues, not just about Islam, such as the current Hindu nationalist government in India, the past U.S. presidents. During our convention in San Francisco, he delivered a really smart and witty talk. He said, "I think the one thing we can now say with a high degree of certainty is that the answers given by every single one of the world's great religions and many of the smaller ones are 100% incorrect. We are no longer these ignorant people who have to tell ourselves these fables." And then he made a remark which has proven so horribly prescient. It's also the theme that Sam Grover has written his blog on. He said, "It's interesting that we live in a time when the Second Amendment is sacrosanct, with the First Amendment under attack every day. We wish Salman Rushdie a speedy recovery because the world needs more brave writers such as him to speak up." We've been busy also on Capitol Hill. We have a staffer there, Mark Dan, our Director of Governmental Affairs, who has really raised our profile in Washington, D.C. Mark writes his dispatch, his monthly dispatch, on how effective he and we have been because of your support and also because of stalwart members of Congress, such as Representative Hank Johnson from Georgia, Jamie Raskin from Maryland, and Jared Huffman from California. Because of all that, we have achieved a number of successes recently. For example, the Thomas Paine Memorial, our most radical founder, free thinker, of course, the author of Common Sense and Age of Reason, is hopefully going to be getting a memorial dedicated to him in D.C. It's moving forward, and we are hoping it'll be a reality before too long. Another thing on which we have been achieving success is these entities called healthcare sharing ministries. I don't know about you, but I didn't know about them before joining FFRF. And I was with the Progressive, and I pride myself on following the news closely. These are entities in which members are required to share a system of religious or ethical beliefs, and they make monthly payments to cover health expenses of other members. They do not have to comply with the consumer protections of the Affordable Care Act. They do not guarantee payment for medical claims. They provide limited benefits for their members and are largely unregulated and shielded by religious exemptions. 1.7 million Americans are members of such organizations. And in July, Representative Jared Huffman introduced the Health Share Transparency Act to rein in and curb these organizations called healthcare sharing ministries. Representative Huffman has also developed a congressional letter to decry what organizations such as Family Research Council are doing, which is converting their tax status to an association of churches. Can you believe it? So they don't have to comply with tax forms. We've also been active on judicial reform, trying to get the Supreme Court bench expanded. And all of this, as I said, due to your support and due to stalwart members of Congress, such as Representative Huffman, Johnson, and Raskin. Among our efforts has been signing on to a joint letter urging the Biden administration to have new rules for faith groups. The Trump administration made it hard for people to get the services they need, made it easy for religious organizations to discriminate in both employment and in the nature of the services they provided and to whom they provided these services. It's very important to get all this taken care of, we urge, and we signed on to a letter that has been sent to the Biden administration by the Coalition Against Religious Discrimination, which you can read in full on our website. Another concern, very recently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the Biden administration regrettably has decided to allow religious schools to discriminate and still remain eligible for federal funding for meal programs for the students. This is highly concerning. As FFRF legal director Rebecca Markert points out, this is a get-out-of-jail-free card for religious schools. They can promise prospective students that they'll be protected from sex-based discrimination and then wait until a lawsuit has been filed against them before claiming that they've been secretly exempt all along. It's deeply unjust and will cause severe harm to students who are duped into attending such schools. But we have glad tidings for you too. We obtained, for example, a victory for free speech in Kansas. We successfully urged Kansas School Board to get rid of a discriminatory dress code that was discriminating against Satanism. We pointed out to them that such a dress code discriminates against minority religions and acts as a prior restraint on student speech. And the school board listened. You know, we are always glad to teach public educational entities the correct constitutional lessons. We are also happy to announce the awarding of almost $20,000 to the winners of the 2022 BIPOC essay. Very fascinating essays. You can see the names of the winners and our announcement on our website. We always feel that free-thinking youth are, so to speak, the salvation of our society. And so it's so wonderful that we've been able to get these essays and share them with you all in subsequent editions of our paper, Free Thought Today. After the break, we interview FFRF attorney Sam Grover about his blog on constitutional absolutes and how they're killing us. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back to Free Thought Radio. This is Amit Pal, guest hosting for Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor, who are in Europe currently. It's a delight to have with me in the studio my colleague, FFRF attorney Sam Grover, and especially to discuss a blog that he's written that really struck me as being very bold and extremely insightful. Sam starts the blog by writing, "In my line of work, I regularly come up against angry religious extremists who wish death upon me and all others who advocate for the constitutional separation of religion and government. My co-workers and I live with the constant reality that we are never entirely safe at work. Even so, I readily acknowledge that the chances of experiencing an active shooter event are remote. But as the recent shootings in Uvalde, Texas, and Highland Park, Illinois have reminded us, in the United States, this type of mass shooting is far more common than it needs to be." The piece is titled, "Thinking in Constitutional Absolutes is Killing People." Sam actually has been with us for a while, because he started with us as an intern back in 2011, I believe. No, 13. 11. And then he came back to us in 2013.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And Sam, we have to talk about your sometime about your experiences in Southern Africa, in Botswana.
That's probably a topic for another show.
Yes, but absolutely, Sam. Welcome. And so I want to start by asking you what particularly prompted you to write this piece.
Yeah, well, thanks, Amit, for having me on. after every mass shooting that happens here in the United States, there's always a clamor for some action, right? For someone to do something. And rarely does that upcry result in material change. So I guess after the Uvalde shooting and the Highland Park shooting on July 4, I thought this was at least one small thing that I could do to write this blog about the problem with mass shootings in the United States, about how it's a fixable problem, right? This is not, you know, mass shootings are here to stay. No, that's a talking point that is simply not true. And so this was, I don't know, the small thing that I could do to at least address the issue in a context that's relevant to freethinkers.
Yes, Sam, I was really taken in by how deftly you tied in FFRF's work and ambit on the First Amendment to the Second Amendment. Can you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. Before I talk about how it relates to state-church separation and our mission, I guess I want to start by just acknowledging that the United States does have a mass shooting problem that is unique amongst countries, right? So the United States is home to more mass shootings than any other country. And with only roughly 5% of the world's population, we experience roughly 31% of all mass shootings. And that's a rate that has tripled since 2011, even as the overall rate of gun violence in the country has declined. So this is a fairly uniquely American problem.
Sure.
And it's one that we have failed to address over and over, even while mass shootings occur on a more than daily basis in this country, depending on how you want to define a mass shooting. With that said, there is some action taking place. The House recently passed the Protecting Our Kids Act, which is one that I would encourage our listeners to go Google and look up.
Certainly, yeah.
To see who's supporting it and who's not. But that bill has languished in the Senate since it moved there in early June. And I doubt that any action will be taken on it, and that is unfortunate. So one of the reasons why it's so hard to pass common sense gun reform in the United States is because the gun rights lobby has pushed a particular view of the Second Amendment that is relevant to FFRF's work. They've pushed this absolutist view where the right to own a gun is absolute, and that's not based on the actual wording in the Constitution. In fact, the Second Amendment is couched in language in the Constitution that makes it very clear that it's a limited right, right? It talks about a well-regulated militia, right? That precedes any declaration of a right to bear arms. And that has been read out of the Constitution by gun rights lobbyists and also now by the Supreme Court. And that same type of reading of a constitutional right is the same type of reading, that absolutist reading, that Orwellian-named groups like First Liberty Institute and Alliance Defending Freedom are trying to do with free exercise, the free exercise of religion clause. So when it comes to Establishment Clause rights, they're being curtailed in this country in favor of a broad, expansive reading of free exercise that allows people not only to believe what they want to believe, but also discriminate against others, to actually act on those beliefs in a way that harms other people, like politically marginalized groups in this country. We've seen it over and over again now. We saw it in the Hobby Lobby case, in Masterpiece Cake Shop, and most recently in Kennedy v. Bremerton, where a coach's individual desire to pray has allowed him to push his religious beliefs on his players. So that absolutist right is killing Americans in the context of the Second Amendment and is undermining state-church separation.
Sam, you've managed to pack in so much just within a few minutes. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Listeners, if you wish to read the blog, it's on our blog site at freethoughtnow.org. Thank you so much, Sam, for coming in and talking about such an important issue with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with an interview with University of Northern Iowa professor Michael Graziano on his book, Errand into the Wilderness of Mirrors, Religion and the History of the CIA. Stay tuned.
This is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, no gods, no masters. This is Free Thought Radio.
And this is Amit Pal, guest hosting for regular hosts Dan Barker and Annie-Laurie Gaylor, who are in Europe right now. I'm delighted to have as my guest for this segment the author of a fascinating book on religion and the CIA. Michael Graziano is Assistant Professor of Religion and the Director of the Institute for Religion and Education at the University of Northern Iowa. His research and teaching focus on law, education and national security in American religion. He received his PhD from Florida State University, and he's the author of the book we'll be discussing, Errand into the Wilderness of Mirrors, Religion and the History of the CIA, published by the University of Chicago Press last year. This explores how U.S. intelligence organizations like the CIA studied religious ideas, individuals, and institutions in the service of U.S. national security, and how they operationalized it at home and abroad. Welcome to the show, Professor Graziano.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, Professor Graziano, can you please... can we please start by you describing for our listeners the major themes of your book?
Absolutely. So my book looks at how American intelligence officers from World War II up through almost to the end of the Cold War tried to use religion to advance U.S. national security in a variety of ways, starting in World War II with the CIA's predecessor, which was known as the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS. They came up with this thing that they called the religious approach to intelligence, and I kind of used that as a frame for the book as a whole. And basically, as American intelligence officers are working on the religious approach to intelligence, there's all sorts of major changes happening in American culture. So there's more interest in what we might call world religions in U.S. culture, both in popular culture on the cover of magazines and TV shows, as well as in educational institutions. And there's also more focus on religious pluralism. So there's more attention paid to the place of religious minorities in American life. And so what my book does is look at what intelligence officers are doing during that time, really from the late 1930s to the early 1980s. And so what I do in the book is looking at this history, this development of a religious approach to consider what it means, to consider what this legacy is for national security and American culture.
So, Professor Graziano, in your book, what comes across is how the CIA fused two quite problematic notions, American exceptionalism, the notion of the United States basically standing out from the rest of the world, with, frankly, what can be considered kind of Orientalist tropes, you know, reducing people to their religion in an extremely reductive way. Could you talk about this, please, and give us a few examples?
Absolutely. So, yeah, one of the curious things that really drew me into the book when I started researching it was that these really kind of popular American ideas about what religion is, how it works, really influenced U.S. intelligence work from World War II on. So there was this very popular idea, in fact, it's still quite popular, that religion was basically a global public good, that religion was universal. Everyone had it. Everywhere you go on the planet, people had religion. You could figure out what it was. And of course, the reality is much more complicated than that. But nonetheless, this idea was very popular in the mid-century United States. And so American intelligence officers came to think that you could basically use one religion to understand other religions. You might have heard this with all kinds of cliches, right, that different religions are, I don't know, different ways up the same mountain, or, you know, blind men touching an elephant, stuff like this. But we know, of course, that religions are different. They ask different questions. They supply different answers. They understand the world in really different ways. But nonetheless, what ended up happening was that American intelligence officers came to think that you could use one religion to translate into another religion universally. And so even if you didn't understand, say, Buddhism or Hinduism, there was a core or an essence to those religions that was similar to Christianity that they might have been more familiar with, and that this opened an avenue to understand these traditions and eventually to manipulate them. And so the connections to Orientalism that you mentioned is that basically from World War II and into the early Cold War, American intelligence officers understood the world's religions as natural allies to the United States, wherever they were, because they assumed that if you were religious, you were fundamentally anti-communist, you were pro-democracy, you were in favor of capitalism, and you were supportive of human liberty and freedom, which were all things that they understood the United States to be in support of. And so religions were presumed friendly almost by default. And so as American intelligence officers are spreading all over the world, but, you know, they're becoming more active in Asia in particular, there's this real intersection of these ideas about American religion that sort of portray Americans as exceptional, as well as longstanding Orientalist ideas that portrayed the people of the quote-unquote Orient as simultaneously barbaric, primitive, but also interesting and exotic. And this influenced intelligence officers as they're trying to understand these people and places. So I think the biggest example here that comes to mind is how American intelligence officers really tried over the course of several decades to understand Islam and to use it for their own ends. So in World War II, the OSS launches what they called the Great Jihad of Freedom to encourage Muslims to rise up against their fascist occupiers in various places. They tried to use Islam as a wedge against the Japanese government in the Pacific theater. And even as they're trying to do this, when you sort of look at the details of some of the operations that they hatched, it's quite clunky. So, for example, there was the idea that one idea that the OSS came up with was to basically fabricate Japanese war plans to kind of like take over Islam. And so they came up with all of these false documents that made it look like the Japanese government was going to replace the role of the Prophet Muhammad with the Japanese emperor, or sort of move the destination of the Hajj from Mecca to Tokyo. And the idea was that, like, once Muslims see this, right, they'll become angry and violent and sort of rise up against the people that are occupying them. And, of course, this is all quite clunky and kind of more than a little silly. But at the same time, there is some kind of sophisticated ideas operating behind the scenes here. Like, they're trying to figure out what's the relationship between belief and action, or can you force action by manipulating belief?
Now that we're on the subject of Islam, something that's really fascinated me and I've written about is the alliance between the United States and Wahhabi Islam, which is the variant of Islam that Saudi Arabia propagates. And ever since the start of the Cold War, there's been an alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia against relatively progressive secular countries in the Middle East, such as Egypt under Nasser. And I would argue to the detriment of the world at large, because these elements have spread the most reactionary, retrograde form of Islam all around the world, and also gave rise to a bunch of jihadists in Afghanistan. Can you please sort of tell us more about this?
Sure. So I don't write a lot on Wahhabi Islam in the book, but one of the things that I do that I think really does shed light on this is the final chapter in my book is about the Iranian Revolution and the CIA's failure to understand Islam's role in that. And I think what comes to mind, you know, thinking about the development of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, is that for a long time, Saudi Arabia and Iran were seen as pillars of U.S. foreign policy in the region. And as you mentioned, by highlighting or bolstering Saudi Arabia, the United States passed over more secularist options, perhaps in large part because they were concerned about what those other forms of Islam, whether they were more friendly to the Soviet Union and communism. And I think one of the things that really comes to mind for me is that in the midst of the Cold War, for a lot of intelligence officers, there was very little gray area between, quote unquote, freedom and communism, that it was difficult to sort of understand different kinds of Islam in any way other than being, you know, pro-American or pro-Soviet.
And also, Professor Graziano, this may not have been the intent, but by associating godlessness with communism, and this will be of particular interest to our members and listeners, aren't you implying that anybody who doesn't believe is necessarily a communist or somebody with communist leanings, which of course hasn't been true either in this country or abroad?
Certainly, yes. There was a widespread concern, not just in intelligence agencies, but in American culture as a whole, as your listeners are well aware, about this supposed relationship between communism and atheism or godlessness, which of course ties into all sorts of other assumptions about people who are atheist or non-theist or irreligious, that they don't have morals or don't know how to act in society, and these kinds of longstanding critiques, which of course we know aren't true, but nonetheless, right, were so pervasive at the time and really influenced a lot of the assumptions made by the U.S. government, including these intelligence officers.
And domestically, did that have any influence on policymaking or attitude toward non-believers, as far as you know?
I think what mostly comes to mind are some of the, pressures to conform that we popularly associate with the 1950s and 1960s, particularly with respect to atheism. There's a number of court cases that take this up. There's, of course, polling data we have that suggests that, atheists and irreligious folks were widely looked down upon. But in terms of the intelligence officers I studied, their attention is mostly focused abroad.
And certainly, attitudes have changed somewhat since then. But as you rightly point out, Professor Graziano, back in the 50s and 60s, it was much more difficult to be a non-believer or not belong to any organized religion in particular. So Professor Graziano is the author of Errand into the Wilderness of Mirrors, Religion and the History of the CIA. And we'll be discussing the book more right after the break.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
This is Amit Pal, guest hosting for Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor, who are in Europe. We are having as our guest Professor Michael Graziano, the author of a fascinating book, Errant into the Wilderness of Mirrors, Religion and the History of the CIA. So, Professor Graziano, as you point out in your book, Catholicism seemed to be the touchstone for the CIA when it came to analyzing religion globally, until it wasn't. One of my the other hats I wear is I teach courses at a local college, and I taught a course on Latin America. And of course, the section on religion dealt with liberation theology. Can you tell our listeners as to a bit about liberation theology and why it was incompatible with the CIA and the United States worldview?
Sure. So liberation theology is a series of ideas that there's all sorts of varieties, but broadly talk about the advancement socially, economically, religiously of people who have been underserved or largely ignored by their governments, right? The advancement of sort of all people on the basis of kind of human equality, a real radical notion of human equality. In Latin America, this becomes associated with some members of the Catholic Church. There's all sorts of, as you can imagine, political challenges with this to some governments in the region, to some members of the church in the region. The United States government is not a big fan about this because to a lot of people, including some of the intelligence officers I studied, this sounds like communism. To be clear, it wasn't. This is not, this is kind of a different thing. But nonetheless, right, it sounded like communism, right? The this kind of radical claim to social and economic equality.
And that's the larger problem, isn't it, Professor Graziano, that the United States is not only aligning itself with religion, but with the most reactionary forms of religion, really. I mean, you know, Wahhabism is fine. The Catholic Church is fine until sort of it moves into a progressive direction. I mean, so anything that sort of is redolent of social justice or is not free market and capitalist enough is suspect, isn't it, in the eyes of the United States?
Well, certainly at the time that I'm studying, you know, in the Cold War, everything was fit into this Cold War framework between the United States and the Soviet Union. And whatever was sort of seen as not sufficiently American was suspect, you know, was suspect or suspected of being in league with, you know, the quote unquote godless communists. And I think that, you know, something your listeners might appreciate or find interesting is that one of the reasons that Catholicism was so popular with U.S. intelligence officers is not that they themselves were Catholic or not that they themselves really had any sort of personal affection for Catholicism. It was that they saw it as easy to understand, that it looked good on an organizational chart, right? You have like the Pope on top and people below him and you've got a nice organization going. And they thought they could just sort of apply this anywhere around the world with other religions, which leads to all sorts of questions that don't make a ton of sense, like who is the Hindu Pope or something like this, right? But the side effect of that is that when it came to things like liberation theology, this really threatened their model for understanding religion, and they reacted accordingly.
Talking of Catholicism, you have a number of fascinating figures in your book, and somebody who actually was a Catholic, and I think that listeners should know more about, is somebody who was known as Wild Bill Donovan. Yeah. I'd love to have that as my nickname, too. Please tell us a bit more about him and his religious background and what he did, because he was somebody quite important, actually, in U.S. history.
Yes, so, yeah, Wild Bill Donovan was the leader of the Office of Strategic Services in World War II. Which was the CIA's predecessor organization, basically. He was a really interesting guy. He was a Catholic, but, you know, in a way that I think is important to keep in mind, he was a Catholic at a time where being Catholic was not necessarily an advantage. There's widespread anti-Catholicism in the United States. Catholics were broadly looked down upon. It was difficult to make headway in government. And so his professional career was really hamstrung by the fact that he was Catholic. But at the same time, you know, he was Catholic, that's what he was born into, but we really don't have any evidence that he cared a lot about it in any kind of like personal theological sense. It was just kind of what you did. And I think that's a useful reminder when we talk about people who are religious, right, that there's all sorts of reasons people are religious, right? Some people might have really deep and interesting feelings about whatever their religion is, and other people might enjoy going because there's free donuts afterward and they get to talk to people or whatever. And with someone like Donovan, he knew a lot about Catholicism. Even though he wasn't personally interested in it, he really thought that Catholicism could be an asset to U.S. intelligence. And one of the big things he did for U.S. intelligence was getting them interested in Catholicism and suggesting that using religion could be one way to advance U.S. interests around the world.
One project that the CIA had during the Cold War that you mentioned quite extensively is the Militant Liberty Project. Fascinating in its kind of, you know, the whole concept behind it. Can you tell our listeners a bit more?
Sure. So Militant Liberty was a project that it never quite got off the ground, but in short, it was a very, very ambitious project to measure freedom in a kind of quantitative way, to measure freedom around the world and figure out where freedom was weak, how it could be improved. It was kind of a wild project, all things considered. But one of the things that happened as a result of that is that, or one of the things you can kind of see with that is that this is another example of the Pentagon, the CIA, other parts of the kind of U.S. defense complex really understanding the world in their own terms, really struggling, in other words, to understand people in their own terms and applying these ideas of American religion and all the ideas that come with that to the world as a whole and assuming that that's going to be good enough to make sense of it. And of course, in this case, it simply wasn't. It's not clear at all what they were really measuring, if anything, and the project never moved forward as a result.
Professor Graziano, we are running out of time, but before I let you go, for you and for our listeners, I wanted to recount an anecdote that will confirm a lot of what you've been studying, and that relates to the Saudi-U.S. alliance. I was in Saudi Arabia back in 2002 as part of a journalistic delegation, and in order to reassure us that we are on the same side, in quotation marks, one of our hosts said, look, you guys, we all are people of the book, and we all have been struggling against godless communism since the 1950s. And, of course, I, as a little believing Hindu, felt a bit left out of that framework.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah.
Just a little bit. But it's fascinating how that's been internalized even abroad. The notion that basically, you know, because the Saudis were believing people, believers, not in the same religion, but loosely sort of, you know, connected with Christianity, that they were on the same side as us against the Soviet Union. And even after September 11th, this was in 2002, he could sort of, you know, say that sort of thing. Well, Professor Graziano, such a pleasure to have you on. Professor Graziano is a professor at the University of Northern Iowa and the author of the book we've been discussing, published by the University of Chicago Press, Errant into the Wilderness of Mirrors, Religion and the History of the CIA. So I would urge listeners to take a look at the book. It's a really fascinating study and provides a lot of understanding of how the U.S. operated during the Cold War. Thank you so much, Professor Graziano.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Free Thought Radio is recorded in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist Studio. Greetings to listeners of WOOM in Philadelphia, WZML in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, WIDE and WMUU in Madison, Wisconsin, WADR in Janesville, Wisconsin, KAOS in College Station, Texas, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, KPW in Eugene, Oregon, Wool Black Sheep Radio in Vermont and New Hampshire, WRIU in Kingston, Rhode Island, WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And if you're listening to the podcast, please give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell your friends and family to learn more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio. You will also enjoy the new podcast, We Dissent, featuring female attorneys working for state-church separation, representing the American Humanist Association, American Atheists, and us at FFRF. You can find that podcast at vdissent.org. Ask for more information about FFRF by visiting ffrf.org. I will end today's show the way Annie Laurie Gaylor always does. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.
This is an emergency podcast system edition of Rumble with Michael Moore. I'm Michael Moore, and my friends, just minutes ago, the state of Kansas, one of the reddest states in this country, a state that Trump won by a margin of almost 60% to 40% over Biden. This state of Kansas has just voted tonight to support abortion rights and to keep the right to abortion in their state constitution.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
60% to 40% of people in Kansas voted to keep abortion legal and available to all women. Nobody saw this coming.
We must be over the rainbow.
This is an amazing thing, but I have to say, and I think we talked about this after the Supreme Court decision a couple of months ago, when that male majority, that Catholic majority on the Supreme Court voted to institute a religious edict on the American people, claiming that life, human life, began when a sperm fertilized an egg, that's a human being. That's what they ruled. And they took away the rights of the majority gender of this country and said, you will not decide what you could do with your body. We, the government, will decide, and we will force you to give birth should you become pregnant. And tonight, in the middle of the country, in the Republican state of Kansas, the people stood in line in a way that they had not done in an off-year election. Nobody can remember when. The average number of Kansas citizens that show up to an election in an off-year election like this year, in a primary, this isn't even the general election, that's in November, or Rovember, as I'm calling it. We're all calling it Rovember from now on, because we are on a march to November. Only 36% usually show up at the Kansas primary in the summer of an off-year election. Over 50% showed up today, stood in line to tell the Supreme Court where they could go. This, they don't know what to do with it right now. I'm watching this on TV. The commentators, they're so befuddled. And because they really wanted, the story tonight was going to be whether or not those who voted, those Republicans who voted for Trump's impeachment, would they get reelected? That was the story they were going into tonight. They still can't get off the story. But we don't have many women anchors. There's certainly very few women commentators here. So I get it. Okay, they've got their script. But here's my script. And this is why I wanted to get this out to you right away. We've had a huge victory tonight. The majority of the American people are with us. The majority, and I don't mean a small majority, a landslide majority in the state of Kansas are with us tonight. And they will be with us in Rovember. We have the chance, my friends, to really take a stand against those who are the enemies of women's rights, the enemies of our democracy, the enemies of those who want to save planet Earth. They are going down. They're going to go down in Rovember, and we are going to be responsible for that, because we are not only all ourselves going to show up to vote, we're going to bring 10 people each with us to vote. They have no idea what they've done. For this number to be this high in Kansas, at 60% plus of people who voted in favor of abortion rights, that means so many Republicans had to have voted for this today. That means people who themselves personally are against abortion, who personally wouldn't have an abortion, they voted in Kansas to keep abortion legal and available to all. This is just a stunning moment. And I want all of you, I know this has been a tough time, 4 years of Trump, then this last year and a half since the January 6th rebellion, and all the evil things that the Supreme Court has done, from taking rights away from women to killing New York's gun control law to gutting the Environmental Protection Agency, and on and on and on. And every time we hear this, we see it, we turn the news off, we can't take it anymore. It never seems to get better. The Democrats are weak. They won't get rid of the filibuster. They won't do what the people want them to do. And so the people in Kansas today just showed up and told them what to do. They made it the law in Kansas. They maintain that the state constitution in Kansas should continue to have legal abortion right now at this very moment. Justice Alito and his cohorts who did this on the Supreme Court, Republican leaders all over the country, Trump himself and all his Trumpsters, they don't know what to do because they have not understood one basic fact. And it's why he lost and why Biden is president. And that's because the vast majority of Americans believe that abortion is a human right. The vast majority of Americans believe we need stronger gun control laws. The vast majority of Americans believe that our planet is in serious trouble regarding what's going on with our environment. They don't understand that the vast majority, pick the subject, the vast majority of Americans want a huge raise in the minimum wage. They want a living wage. The vast majority of Americans believe health care should be free for all Americans. The vast majority of Americans believe that college should be free, that there should be, when you have a baby, there should be a leave, a paid leave for women and men. That's the country we live in. That's who we are. And this country is, what is going to happen in the next 3 months? And let me just make this clear. It won't happen on its own. There are no guarantees. There's no spiking the football here on the 1 yard line. Think of that. Oh, we've got it made now. We never have it made. You know that. I don't have to tell you that. It sucks most of the time because we, the people, are never listened to. The politicians don't stand up for us, including the ones that we vote for. So we know this feeling of despair. It's never going to get better. There's no way for us to win. The billionaires control this country. They buy the politicians. And then suddenly something like this happens. And we're reminded that even though our democracy is still hanging on by a thread, we the people, still barely are in charge. And we are going to have our say come November the 8th. Make a plan right now, my friends, to do whatever you can do in these 3 months. Call whatever local group is organizing. Let's get the vote out. Call in right now to whoever at work. Call in for a day off, a vacation day, whatever day, on November 7th or 8th, the day of the election, the day before, the weekend before. All of us knocking on doors, all of us making phone calls, all of us guaranteeing and getting everybody we know to show up, to vote, to take our country back We are the majority. Why should we even have to take it back? It's ours. The vast, vast majority of our fellow Americans agree with us on nearly every single issue. Now is our moment. Now is our time. People of Kansas, I can't thank you enough for what you've done to lift our spirits and to send us forward in making sure that these Republicans, the 147 of them who on January 6, 2021, voted to not accept the legal results of the 2020 election, voted in Congress to stop Joe Biden from taking office. These people are traitors. And as much as whatever bullshit they've fed us over the years about, oh, they're all for America, they're all for law and order, as they beat the police there on the Capitol steps. These liars, as they voted down last week the bill to help the veterans who are suffering with health problems. This is pure evil, my friends, and you know it, and I know it. And while some of them are family members and some of them are neighbors, they have to be stopped. Just like you have to stop any bully, just like you have to stop anybody who's out of control and is going to do damage to others and to themselves. And this is our job between now and Rovember the 8th. Let's do it. Let's all be from Kansas tonight. Thank you, my friends. We've got work ahead of us. Enough talk. This is Michael Moore, and this is Rumble. Thank you for tuning into this Emergency Podcast System edition of my podcast. Somewhere.